This is an Overcoat Media production.
Welcome to Memento Morbid, where we explore death, life, and the in-between. It's hosted by me, Joanna Ebenstein, founder of Morbid Anatomy, an organization and community devoted to these very themes. Hello. During this episode of Memento Morbid, if any names, books, ideas, or artworks spark your curiosity, check out the podcast show notes for more. You'll also find a link to our Substack, which contains imagery discussed and additional content. Today's guest is a writer and cultural thinker whose work explores the Gothic, not as fantasy, but as something deeply embedded in our homes, our histories, and our bodies.
I used to live near a cemetery, and me and my friends would go, like, and basically play funeral.
You would play funeral? Wait, can you talk a little bit more about what that was like?
We would, like, take turns being, like, the dead person, and then, like, the people around you would, like, be sad and cry, you know? Yeah, you'd be take turns being a dead person at a funeral.
I love that.
And there was also, this seems so dangerous at the time, but I guess it was the 70s. There was an open grave, like, they had dug the hole that somebody was going to go into and just kind of left it, and or like taking dirt out of it and making mud pies. And I just remember, it was like, this is the best dirt for mud pies. It's like red dirt.
Before we bring in today's guest, let's enjoy a listener's story, question, or encounter revolving around the draw of the Gothic in their own lives.
I'm Adam from Wales in the UK. I consider myself a closet goth, a lover of the aesthetic, music, aura of a connection to mystical, macabre, and melancholy things. On the surface, you'd have no idea. I am, and have always been, as plain and as boring as can be. I loved all things spooky as a kid, from scary movies and TV shows. I loved the thrill of being scared shitless and the excitement that came with it. I knew something was a little off when I desperately tried to manifest nightmares before going to sleep each and every night, surrounding myself with all things Ghostbusters in the hope that I might attract some spooky dreams and feel the thrill in sleep and wake up abruptly with a racing heart. As an aside, from an early age I was convinced I was either a witch in a previous life or would fall in love with a witch and my inner dark soul would be released and flourished. One of the things that most interested me from an early age was death. Not just the act or moment of it, but the senses linked to it. The most appealing of which definitely was imagery. Anatomical drawings of things like hearts and fungi, hideous creatures, the moon, coughings, anything that hinted at death, spooky or kind of unnormal. My first tattoo was an appalling cartoony doodle featuring a skull, a gravestone, a black bouquet, a crucifix. There's always been a goth spirit within me.
Thank you so much. If you have your own offering, a reflection, memory, or encounter that you'd like to share, please send us a WhatsApp voice note. You will find the number in the episode description. Just add it to your contacts. Today, I'm delighted to welcome Leela Taylor. Leela is a writer, designer, and cultural critic whose work examines the Gothic, horror, and the architecture of dread, particularly through the lens of Black history and American cultural life. She is the author of Darkly, Black History in America's Gothic Soul, a powerful and personal reframing of the American Gothic tradition, and the recently published Sick Houses, Haunted Homes and the Architecture of Dread, which explores why houses so often become vessels for fear, memory, and psychic disturbance. She is also the creative director of the Brooklyn Public Library. Leela is a longtime member of the Morbid Anatomy community, where she has given many brilliant talks based on her unique and fascinating scholarship. I'm so excited to have her here today. Leela, welcome to the show. It's so nice to have you here. I feel like I've known about your work for a long time, but we've never had a formal talk about it. And I'm so excited to talk more with you.
I'm so happy to be here. I think this is great. Yeah, I'm excited too.
Well, you know, my first curiosity when I was looking over all the books you've written and then your day job, well, two questions came from that. The number one question that came from that is, what did you study in school? How did you get here?
Yeah, oddly enough, graphic design. Okay. So my undergrad was graphic design at the University of Cincinnati. Then I worked at a design agency for a few years, and I got a master's degree from Yale in graphic design.
Got it.
And then continued to work as a graphic designer. So mostly my career, my life has been in graphic design.
Got it.
And but I always wrote on the side. And I would say maybe 15 years ago, I started doing some, I guess, sort of cultural theory type stuff and writing articles about things I thought were interesting and was not getting published anywhere. And it occurred to me that I don't know what I'm doing. Like, all I know is design, right? And there were some really basic things about writing that I just never did. And I was like, I really want to kind of take this seriously. I decided to go back to grad school. So I applied to the New School in their liberal studies program, which was great. It was sort of this place where people who didn't really belong anywhere else kind of fit in really well. And, you know, I'm an older student, you know, I've had a whole career that, and I'm changing not my career necessarily, but I'm going into something completely new. Then, while I was in this process of applying at the New School, this job opened up at Brooklyn Public Library for creative director, which was like, oh, this is my dream job. And I've honestly been keeping my eye on this position for a while now. I've just sort of been like, if anything opens up, and it did. So I was like, well, I have to apply to this. And I didn't know if I was going to be accepted in the New School. I didn't know I was going to be accepted at the library. And I got both.
So much to do.
In grad school and working full time.
Wow.
Which was...
Had a brand new job.
Yeah, it was a lot.
Yeah.
I didn't sleep a lot or see a lot of people for like 3 years.
Well, I have so many questions. But my first practical question is, being the creative director of the Brooklyn Public Library, what does that entail?
So I'm part of the marketing and communications department.
Okay.
So we essentially handle all of the communications about the library to the public.
Got it.
And to staff. It could be programming. It could be special events. It could be changes in policy. We manage the website, the social media accounts. We have an in-house design department. So I manage that team.
Got it.
So I like to see basically anything that has the Brooklyn Public Library on it that looks good came through my world at some point.
But in a strange way, this is also a bridge to your writing, right? Because you're a lover of books. And for those listeners who have not been to the Brooklyn Public Library, especially the main branch where Layla works, it's gorgeous. It's like a palace of a library with beautiful Art Deco gold designs on the outside and an incredible collection that's available to the public. And Layla also, in your capacity, donated some books that were no longer going to be part of the collection to the Morven Anatomy Library.
It was great.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, and one of the books is called Phone Calls from the Dead. That's probably my absolute favorite.
Yeah, yeah. That was a fun day.
Yeah.
That was awesome.
That was an amazing day. And so, you know, I'm also wondering, like, when you decided to go to grad school and learn to be a writer, did you have an idea of what the final project you wanted to do with your new knowledge would be?
Well, originally, I was interested in looking at Black kids and goth culture, but I'm not a sociologist. Yeah, I went in with the intent of writing a book, of writing darkly, coming out with that. So it was good to have that kind of focus immediately. Like, I wasn't just going into it as an experiment or as a just to sort of generally learn about things. I was like, I want to come out of here with the beginnings of a book. And I was really, like, I knew who I wanted to work with. I wanted to work with Dominic Pettman and Eugene Thacker. And I was like, I will make them my thesis advisors.
That's amazing.
And they were. And I was like, I'll make these people my thesis advisors. And they were fantastic. And it was really great. It was a really good experience that I'm still paying off. And probably will be for a very long time.
But worth it, it sounds like.
But yeah.
And could you speak a little bit more for people who aren't familiar with Darkly about what that book is, what its scope is, what you were what inspired you to do it, and what you wanted to kind of cover in there?
Yeah. So the book is called Darkly, Black History and America's Gothic Soul. And kind of as I said, I started off wanting to look at this particular subculture that was dear to me, that I grew up as a, you know, kind of a goth kid in Detroit in the 80s. But I wanted to look at other people in this scene who might have not fit in because they were Black, or might have felt they didn't fit in because they were Black, and what it meant to be a minority in a subculture. There are two things that kind of made this bigger for me. One is I saw a t-shirt that said, "So goth, I was born Black," which I thought, that's hilarious. But then I was thinking, well, what does that actually mean? What does it mean that gothicness or gothness is inherently Black? And what is inherently Black about goth, right? The other thing was Billie Holiday's Strange Fruit. And I was listening to that song and I was like, this is the most goth song I've ever heard. And gothic song, because like those are two different things in my world. And I thought, well, one of the reasons that made this so goth is because it's true. Because it's taking this horror, this absolutely horrible event, the lynching of two men in Indiana, that is described in this very visceral way, but that's beautifully rendered, and it's haunting, and it's eerie, and it's all of those qualities that I associate with that kind of dark romanticism of the gothic, right? And also Toni Morrison's Beloved. And again, this is, it's, which is a ghost story. It's essentially a haunted house story that is horrifying, and it's true. It's based on a true story. So I was looking at these two sort of artifacts of culture and saying, well, this is so much a part of American history. This is who we are. It's just what we came out of. In its nature, it's completely gothic. It's a very, they're gothic tropes, right? So that's what kind of gelled about it. And so I started looking at, one, myself as feeling like a goth kid in Detroit, and what that felt like and what that meant to me, but also looking at our history, contemporary and past, and all of the things that being Black in America means, and how that's translated and metamorphosized all that pain and anger and sorrow that was sort of inherited from the transatlantic slave trade, how that's metamorphosized into music and art and dance and fashion and culture and all of those things and literature. And I was like, that's that culture that is American Gothic. That is the American Gothic. So that's where it came from. Yeah. And I have a tendency to be very, I have a lot of dots in my head, and I just like string the dots together is basically how I work.
Yeah. I can definitely identify with that. I wonder if you might expand a little bit on the idea of the difference between the gothic and the goth that you kind of tantalizingly referenced just now.
Yeah. So, and again, this is me. I know that people have strong feelings about these things.
Yeah, this is, yeah, obviously, but everyone has their own personal, but I mean, you've really taken this and run with it in so many interesting directions. I would just love to know kind of how you think about the goth, the gothic, and how that relates to your subject. Yeah.
For me, goth is a subculture, is a music subculture and a music genre, or a music genre and the subculture that emerged from that. So to me, goth is really specific, you know, kind of arising from, you know, Joy Division. And there are going to be lots of people are like, it didn't start then, it started way back then or whatever. But it's The Cure and Susie and the Banshees, you know, Sisters of Mercy and et cetera, et cetera. The goth music, or what has been labeled goth music, I should say, and the fashion and the culture that has developed from that, that's kind of ever changing. Gothic is a much more fluid definition. It's kind of, it's a sensibility. The Gothic, if we want to get really technical, could be sort of established way back in England. The Gothic is a literary genre, and I'm referring to the literary genre, but it's also an architectural style. It's also a music style that is evocative of sorrow, of mourning, of beauty in that, of death, of the things that are morbid, of the things that are macabre, the things that we sort of run away from, the dark things. It's the spooky castle on the hill and cobwebs. It's the literature of that, whether it's sort of Wuthering Heights or Frankenstein. So the Gothic is a sensibility and it's a style that has arisen mostly from Britain. So Gothic is a sensibility and a literary genre. Yeah. Goth is a music style.
And how did you, when you were a young person in Detroit, how did you find the Goths and how did you know they were your pupil?
I think, I'm trying to remember how I discovered Susie and the Banshees. There was really great radio stations in Detroit and really great record stores. Mm. And me and my friend used to go to record stores and listen to the radio and discover these bands. And I wish I had a moment that was this like, aha, like, oh, I picked up my first, you know, Cure album or what have you. But it was all the music. And it was a combination of that and Anne Rice. Like, I think I discovered Anne Rice and like Susie and the Banshees around like 13 or something like that. And that was just like, this light bulb went off in my head. I was like, oh, whatever this is what I am. And it's interesting. I was talking to a friend of mine about music in Detroit. And I was growing up at like the golden age of house music in Detroit. And that I was completely oblivious to because I was listening to Depeche Mode, you know. So I completely missed this sort of renaissance of house and techno music that was happening in Detroit. But even before that, I was always kind of a spooky kid. I used to live near a cemetery when we lived in Massachusetts. And me and my friends would go, like, and basically play funeral in the cemetery.
You would play funeral? Like, can you talk a little bit more about what that was like?
We would, like, take turns being, like, the dead person. And then, like, the people around you would, like, be sad and cry, you know? Yeah, you'd be take turns being a dead person at a funeral.
I love that.
And there was also, I remember once there was, this seems so dangerous at the time, but I guess it was the 70s. There was an open grave. Like, they had dug the hole that somebody was going to go into and just kind of left it. So he found like this grave and we're like taking dirt out of it and making mud pies. And I just remember it was like, this is the best dirt for mud pies. It was like grave dirt.
Wow.
But I was also really interested in death and what happened afterwards. Yeah. You know, this idea of an afterlife and what that meant. Interested in the sort of occult stuff and yeah. Not so much magic stuff, but kind of witchy stuff and anything that was in that Time Life series.
Man, Myth, and Magic?
Yes. Oh, no, series of the Unknown. I forget what it's called.
Okay.
Anything that was about the other, I was sort of fascinated. I was always fascinated by.
The mystery.
I may not have had the vocabulary for it at the time.
Yeah.
Or knew that there were like whole chunks of people who liked all the same stuff that I did. But yeah, I would say as a middle schooler, it's probably when I and my friends discovered goth music.
Yeah. I love that you tied it into that youthful fascination with the mysterious and the unknown, which I think probably every guest that I've had would relate to. Certainly I would.
Yeah.
That's just so interesting. And, hearing you talk about it, and of course, in the context of death, that is, you know, one of the great frames of Morbid Anatomy, I wonder if this isn't a youthful, at least in part, attempt to wrap one's head around the great mysteries of life that aren't being answered by our families and by our cultural systems and maybe by our religions. I don't know. Were you brought up religious in your family?
Not really. There was this period of time when we went to church. We went to Congregationalist United Church of Christ, which is a very like NPR public, you know, not a part of Protestantism. And we went through this kind of short period, but it was more like a cultural, social thing. Yeah. Like you should go to church, buy cookies at the bake sale.
Yeah.
And then
like community.
We got to go to IHOP afterwards. Yeah. Community, yeah. I mean, there wasn't a lot of talk of hell. There was no talk of hell.
That's nice.
Or even heaven. I mean, the nice thing about the church I grew up in was it was very focused on activism. Hmm. The first Black, the first female, the first gay, ministers of any denomination were Congregationalists. They were UCC, United Church of Christ. Everything was sort of about activism and helping. And the way my feeling with church and the religion that I was around was essentially, don't be an asshole. And if you can help somebody, help them. And that's it. There wasn't any like fire and brimstone. There was no like sin. It was just sort of, you know, we're put on this planet to help other people, you know. And it was very mild.
Yeah. And also from what you're saying, no real engagement with what happens after life, right?
Not that I ever remember.
Yeah.
Which is maybe why I was intrigued by some of these things, because church was really boring. It was a lot of drama in church, right?
Yeah.
And maybe it was a little unsatisfying.
Yeah, I could see that.
Because I didn't have this really strong belief or faith that this definite thing happens when you die, I was just sort of curious, well, what does happen? What could happen? Like, I remember I had this vision of heaven as like a really like fancy hotel that you could go to. So I think as a little kid, that was like the most, you know, heaven-like thing I could think of, was just a really, really fancy hotel. And even as an adult, I'm like, yeah, that'd be
great. I know, I heard you say it. I'm like, is there room service? That sounds okay to me.
I know, exactly.
That sounds like a good heaven to me. You know, I wonder too, you know, we've been talking about goth, and I, you know, it's something obviously I think a lot about too, having been drawn to that world as a youth and many of my friends and many of the Morven Nemi community. And I wonder, you know, I've been thinking recently about why we're drawn to it, you know, why we're drawn to the goth in particular. And I would love to hear your thoughts on that, because you've done so much more research than I have, and you know so much more about it.
I think the thing that I love about goth and the gothic, or maybe specifically goth culture, is that it's this embrace of the full range of human experience. Like, I think a lot of our culture is about tamping down the bad feelings and avoiding bad feelings and avoiding mourning and avoiding sad and either getting over it, just getting over whatever the bad stuff is and moving on. And this fear of talking about it, this fear of, I don't know, especially now, I think there is this tremendous fear of vulnerability. And the thing that I love about goth and the gothic is looking at all of those so-called negative feelings, fear, sadness, anger, all of those things that are supposed to be things to avoid in goth culture are embraced. And I think one of the healthiest things we can kind of do as a culture is look at those things in the face and not avoid them. Look at the things in our history that are bad. Look at the feelings that we have that might be painful inside and face them and deal with them instead of try to suffocate them. That, and I love the idea of beauty out of the horrible or beauty out of things that are supposed to be repulsive or whatever. It's why I love ruins. I love building ruins or something about kind of facing the passage of time in that way that I think is really lovely. I mean, essentially the gothic is dark romanticism. And I think that's what goth is. Goth is a very romanticized, romantic culture. It's a very, you know, hand on the forehead swoon kind of culture. And a lot of people have this misunderstanding that goth people are depressed all the time. But my feeling was always like, if you are someone who spends, you know, 2 hours getting ready and putting makeup on and wearing like all velvet in the middle of summer, you know, in parasols down the street, that is not like, that does not look like depression to me. Depression to me looks like sitting on the couch and watching TV and doing nothing. Yeah. That's not what goth is. It's melodrama and the theatrics of it, I love.
Yeah, likewise. And I really love, I feel like you kind of came full circle back to when we were talking about Billie Holiday's Strange Fruit, talking about the beauty, you know, like it's such a beautiful song about such a horrific concept and moment. And, you know, this is what you're kind of talking about, goth crystallizing as well. And I think that's a really great point. And I've always wondered, or often wondered, if, you know, the kind of evergreen aspect of goth music, the fact that it's not going away, which if you, someone had told you in the 80s that there's, I just learned last night that my best friend in college's daughter has a goth night that she's doing, you know, I know. And I was like, wait, what? Yeah, congratulations, first of all. But second of all, it's still going on, right? Exactly. Pretty much. I know there's changes. Yeah. I don't want to be disrespectful of that. There's new bands and new references and I'm sure nuances that we don't understand, but it's continuing on much as it was when we were young, which I think not many subcultures have that kind of traction, which makes me think there's something we need, something our culture needs in the goth, and something it can learn from it, you know?
Yeah. And again, because it comes from a sensibility. Yes. It comes from a perspective of life and a way of looking at things.
Yeah. And I think just to piggyback on what you were saying too, it's also coming from like a lack in our culture. There's like a, you know, from Jung's perspective, right? The things that we repress or don't talk about or avoid, he called the shadow. So it's really like the goths are excavating and bringing to light this part of our culture that is real. People die, people suffer. We suffer, right? Yeah. I think probably most people who end up in goth subculture suffered in some way. I think there's a relationship between trauma and I've often wondered too, in a culture that, as you alluded to, right, the United States culture is so adamantly positive, you know, and especially I grew up in California, which is even more so for people who have Holocaust survivors in the family or slavery in their background. It's not representing our reality, which is a bittersweet reality, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I come from the Midwest, which has its own weird kind of passive aggressive politeness kind of thing in and of itself. But yeah, again, like if you're a Black person in America, if you're a Native person, if you are a Latino person now, if you are a Muslim person in this country now, you see the reality of the world much, much clearer because you see, first of all, you generationally have lived through repression and subjugation and murder and exploitation. So you have all of that generational pain, right?
Yeah.
But your day-to-day life is much more not focused on, but you see the truth, you see the reality of the world around you in a way that you don't or don't have to if you're of the dominant culture. Essentially, if you're a white person, a white, cisgendered, able-bodied, usually male person, you have to go out of your way to learn about someone who's oppressed, to learn about other people's pain and oppression, to learn about other people's histories of trauma, right? Because you can go your entire life just fine without having to face any of that, right? So it's a choice to look at other people and other people's experiences and be empathetic and want to learn more and appreciate it. So I think, again, the thing with goth culture is about looking at those experiences and those feelings that other people might be facing and realizing I feel those things too in my own different way, you know, and I can relate to those people from what they do. I mean, I'm not trying to say that there's definitely, you know, racism in all culture, in all subcultures, and all subcultures have their issues with that. But in its purest form, I would say goth culture is about empathy. I would want it to be about empathy.
I love that.
Because you kind of have to, if you're dealing with things like the melancholy and you're dealing with things like death, how can you not? How can you not be empathetic of other people's experiences? So sometimes it fails short as, you know, as a culture, but to me, that's kind of what it's about. That sounds very corny.
Yeah, I think that's beautiful, Leila. No, it doesn't. I think it's beautiful. And I think it speaks to, you know, I mean, one thing that I'm always struck when I go to the UK is they take their subculture so much more seriously than we do in the United States. Like the last time I was there, I saw a full-on exhibition at the Design Museum about the history of New Romanticism. You know?
Oh,
I know.
Nice.
Well, it's going to go up on our Patreon soon, but it's like, the texts, the care and the appreciation and the socioeconomic analysis of where it came from was really dignified it and gave it, you know, there's an appreciation for these things that in the United States, I think, we don't see a whole lot of, you know, it's only this, yeah. It's just this. But in the UK, and I don't know why this is the case, but it seems to me that there's a much stronger appreciation for these subcultures and their importance. And I do think there's something important about it socially. And again, going back to the fact it's still around, it's answering some need, you know, it's fulfilling something that's missing in our culture. And I love that your work is really about bringing that, giving that space, dignity, talking about it in an intelligent, but also, you know, you're so good at making things fun and accessible at the same time that you bring so much scholarship and knowledge. And that's something I really appreciate in your talks, especially. But I also would like to ask you about your new book. So how did you move? I mean, I can see some obvious connections, but how did you move from goth culture to haunted houses with your new book, Sick Houses, Haunted Homes, and the Architecture of Dread?
Well, horror, I will watch any horror movie any day. I'm a huge fan of horror films, but haunted house movies and haunted house stories, the haunted house as a genre has always been my favorite form of horror. There's this kind of given that the haunted house has a story. Again, the first gothic novel ever written was about a haunted house, right? Mm. Its longevity and the fact that it has sustained itself for so long. People kind of forget about it. Like, oh yeah, haunted house, of course, that's a thing. And I was kind of like, well, why? Why are Victorian mansions the default spooky haunted house, Halloween house? Why is that? Why do we feel certain spaces are eerie or disturbing based on their architecture, based on their construction? Why do places feel bad? Why do places feel wrong? And I was looking at, again, I was looking at movies that I love so much, and I wanted to explore a little bit deeper these stories. There's a combination of real events, historical events, historical periods in time, architectural genres that have changed over time, and movie references and things like that. Take something like Ed Gein's house, the serial killer, the abandoned farmhouse on the countryside that's sort of been left to rot. Why has that become this symbol of a particular kind of American kind of horror? What's scary about that? Why are villains in movies always in a modern, brutalist, fancy glass-walled building suspended over a cliff? Yeah, so I wanted to look at the things that I love about architecture and the things that I love about buildings. I kind of fall in love with buildings. I get crushes on buildings and I get kind of obsessed with them in a lot of ways. I was really obsessed with the Unabomber cabin for a very long time. And I was like, there's something wrong with this structure. Like, forget about Ted Kaczynski. I'm not talking about Ted Kaczynski. I'm just talking about the actual form of his cabin. And I was like, there's something weird about the proportions of this. What is it about this structure that gives me the heebie-jeebies? And so I get into a little bit about, well, why, because of what happened in that cabin, but maybe also because of the structure itself. Like, it's a little bit oddly too symmetrical, but not symmetrical. Like, the proportions are weird. I was also very fascinated by this idea of the witch house and why a house that's kind of falling apart, that might be kind of decrepit, that might be a little spooky, why that is labeled a quote-unquote witch house in most neighborhoods. You know, why are people so afraid? Or what is this fear of, you know, a single, never married, postmenopausal, childless woman living by herself with a couple of cats? Like, why has that become such a symbol of fear in this country? So it's looking at what these buildings are and who lives in these buildings and what it means sort of culturally. So yeah, that's a long rambling explanation.
No, that's great. And so that leads me to wonder, what are you working on now, if anything?
I really love doing presentations. And I never thought that this would be a thing that I love to do, about doing sort of illustrated talks. 14-year-old me knew that I made PowerPoint presentations for fun. She'd be completely, you know, disgusted. But I've been doing this talk about sound, about the sound of haunting.
Yes, you did that talk for us.
And why usually the first sort of sign of a haunting or ghost presence in a space is sound, is sort of footsteps and creaks, or there is a whole sort of genre of ghosts communicating to us on the other side through technology, through phones, through computers, yes, and things like that.
Phone calls from the dead. The book you donated to us is all about that.
Phone calls from the dead, exactly. Yeah, so I think the next thing I'm working on is about the sound of ghosts and the sound of haunting, and why, how sound plays such an important part with us emotionally, and how it's so easy to play with. Yeah, how, again, sort of in films, in music, in culture, in my own experience, what sound means to me. I also have misophonia, so there's some sounds that...
What is misophonia?
It's this condition where there's some sounds that will just drive you crazy. For some people, it's like chewing gum or hearing the sound of someone of like someone chewing and things like that.
Yeah.
To me, it's whistling. It's whistling and humming. Mm. I don't know why, but someone could like be whistling a tune like three blocks away, and I'll just be like, "Who's whistling? Who? Stop that whistling!" Like I'll get it just gets under my skin. Sound is a very emotional thing. I think for most people, and for most people, music is emotion, and it's memory, and it's evocative of so many different things in your life. I think there are some people, me included, where you could hear a song and know exactly where you were, where you first heard it, or it will evoke a certain feeling.
Yeah, for sure.
Like the thing I find so fascinating about music is why and how does music without lyrics make you feel? Make you feel sad or make you feel happy? And it's just sound. There's no words. There's no story. It's just sound. So the idea of sound as being kind of a ghostly trace is what I'm kind of interested in. So, and a lot of it is also about sort of things like the stone tape theory, which is this idea that a haunting is essentially a recording of an experience that plays over and over and over again. So get, yeah, a lot, again, like my big board of dots that I just need to connect in a few places. But yeah, so that's the thing I'm working on, is something about the sound of haunting or the sound of ghosts.
Sounds incredible. I love that. And so I'm ending these interviews with three questions I ask each person. So I want to ask you, first of all, looking back over the course of your life and work, how has the idea of death animated it or inspired it?
I think death has never scared me. So I think I'm not like a particular daredevil. I don't go out seeking things that could cause me to die. I don't go out seeking death. But I think because I don't have a fear of it, and because I find it so fascinating, scientifically, I find it fascinating. Like, what happens when you decay? I think it kind of sets me up to be a little braver about things, I guess. I'm kind of led by my curiosity more than, you know, I got to avoid this. You know, I don't really feel like, oh, I got to get this done because I could die. I kind of think, I don't know, like, what happens? What happens when I die? I don't know. I don't know if that answers the question, but I think it's...
Absolutely.
Because our culture is so focused on the fear of death and the sorrow of death. I think a lot of my work is about, well, why? Why is that? Why should we be sad? Why should we be scared? Yeah.
And I feel like also your work is about, like, and what have we lost by doing so, right? Like, what are we missing through that?
Yeah, exactly. And the thing I love so much about Morbid Anatomy and the writers and the artists and the makers who have kind of come through this little community is that you learn so much when you kind of open your eyes to these things. And you just get fascinating creative results, you know, if you don't look away, if you don't turn away from it, you know.
Yeah, I think that's very beautifully said. Thank you. My next question is, if you could live forever, would you? And why or why not?
No. I have decided to live forever. I mean, I think, I'm not a religious person, but I sort of feel like one of the great things about being human is that we end, and we're supposed to end, you know? So there's something a little bit hubristic, or there's something a little bit like, why should I live forever? What is so great about me that I should live forever? No way. Also, I just find it would be exhausting. I don't know. I mean, the only way I would want to live forever, if I could be like a head in a jar or something, I don't know. I wouldn't want to have to like maintain my health for like all of eternity, you know. I wouldn't want to have to eat just like, you know, baked chicken breasts and broccoli for like 400 years. Like, you know what I mean? Like, unless I was a vampire. If I was a vampire, that'd be cool. But even then, that'd probably get boring after a while.
Yeah. I mean, that's definitely what Anne Rice would have us think. Or if not boring, then existentially despondent.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. And finally, has your work changed your thoughts about death and what might or might not happen after?
Yeah, I would say. I would say the thing, like, people have asked me, do I believe in ghosts? And for a while, I'd be like, no. I'm kind of one of those people who feels like there is nothing is supernatural. It's just we haven't discovered it yet. Everything is natural. We just don't necessarily know it, you know? And I think that idea is kind of gelled. It's kind of solidified in how I feel about life after death. That's why I love this idea of the trace or the recording. Instead of as I've been kind of, you know, reading and writing about this stuff, the idea of a ghost as being a presence that's staying or that has unfinished business or a spirit that has not gone on, I find really sad. But the idea of a ghost, quote unquote, not actually being a thing that's there, but just sort of a smell, a sound, a scent, a remnant of something that happened in the past, I think is quite beautiful. And I love the idea of the afterlife or a spirit or a ghost or whatever happens as being the sort of overlapping of time where you're seeing something or experiencing the past in the present simultaneously, which I think is quite lovely. So I think in a lot of ways, my attitudes about death, my feelings about death or life after death are getting a little bit more refined.
Okay. And so to end, how can our listeners find out more about you and your work?
I would say I'm mostly on Instagram.
Okay.
A little bit less these days. I am going to start a Substack, I swear. I really am. But I would say I'm on Blue Sky and I'm on Instagram. And that's probably the most common place.
What is your handle there? Is it Leila Taylor, one word, or how would they find you there?
On Instagram, I am, and I always have to remind myself because it's like memorizing your own phone number.
Totally.
Just Leila Taylor, L-E-I-L-A,
Leila Taylor.
T-A-Y. L-O-R.
Fantastic.
So that's how you can find me.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for being here with us today.
This is fun. Yeah.
Great. Well, and hopefully I'll see you when I'm back in New York.
Yes. Thank you.
So after each episode, my producer, Jess, and I like to discuss the interview. So I'm going to turn it over to Jess. Jess, what jumped out at you today about our talk with Leila?
Leila was great, wasn't she? That was... such a fascinating kind of collection of conversations. Right up at the start, you were talking about the difference between goth and gothic, you know, and that was something really interesting to ponder on. I was quite into the fact that both had kind of British origins there, you know, given given my own background,
your own predilections.
Yeah, were you a goth as a kid?
No, I was goth adjacent, I would say. I
Goth
never
adjacent.
identified as a goth, but I liked a lot of the music and I appreciated their love of literature. But I found when I became friends with the ones that I knew in Northern California anyway, they didn't actually read. They just talked about the books. And I was very disenchanted with that. I was a super book nerd. So I was
They
more
just
a book
hold it and
nerd.
pretend to be, yeah.
Exactly. They talked about Edgar Allan Poe, but had never read his stuff, et cetera.
Yeah, I think I was more grunge than goth. But it was great hearing about the kind of music that Leela was into, Susie Sue and the Banshees and the Cure and things like that.
All British.
But yeah, exactly. But yeah, in terms of the gothic as well, of that being a whole sensibility, and when she was listing off the things that go along with that, beauty and death and morbid and literature and the scholarly, I was like, you're describing all the morbid anatomy things there, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's no coincidence that many morbid anatomists are former goths or were goth adjacent, including Leela.
Yeah. And when you kind of went back to childhood and she said, you know, I was always kind of a spooky kid. And I think a lot of us can relate to that as well, that are part of the morbid anatomy community and observers. How fascinating was that, playing the funeral games?
I know, and she just said it like it was no big deal. I was like, wow, I've never heard of that before. Yeah, that was actually really amazing.
Yeah, I was like, God, I wish I had done that as a kid. I found a picture yesterday of me when I was like 2, just sat really solemnly on a grave in a graveyard. I was like, oh, I have always been that kid. But yeah, just the idea of them when she was like, mud pies, no, you make the best mud pies out of grave dirt.
Yeah,
I
that
was
was
like, you're my kind of
full
woman.
on.
And yeah, and then you're kind of talking about the buildings with her, and that's fascinating as well, you know. What she was saying about the Unabomber cabin. I have no idea what that is. Well, I know what the Unabomber is, but I have no idea about
Yeah,
the cabin, so
I
I'm going to
know
have to look.
it made me want to go back and look at photos of it. I don't know either, but I loved her implication that, perhaps it was the architecture that in part inspired the actions, which is, I just think, a really interesting idea.
Yeah. And her thoughts on sound as well, and hauntings being rather than someone left behind or someone or a soul unable to transition, hauntings being a trace or a recording and stone tape and
Yeah. Did you grow up with a stone tape? I know that's a British TV thing.
well, I know that the stone tape theory exists,
Yeah.
as in, like, I mean, I made a documentary a while ago
Oh.
about Welsh Halloween, and we were in a very old building, and the guy in there was kind of explaining to us that what the stones possessed within them, you know, what it within stone tape theory, but not as a specific show or anything like that, but it's yeah.
Yeah, I think there's some BBC show. I can't remember what the name of the show was, but it has to do, if you look up Hauntology Stone Tape, it might have been called The Stone Tape. It was an episode of
Oh.
something. So it's part of like the British cultural tradition of like children's television of the 70s, from what I understand.
Oh,
Yeah.
yeah,
Yeah,
I'm
you've got a
80s, so
lot
I
to
might miss it. But I'm
discover.
going to have to find this now.
Yeah,
And
just do a
yeah, I mean, if
search.
I
You'll
can find
find.
it, I'll link it in our
Oh,
Substack for
that's a great
sure.
idea.
But yeah, and I'm really excited for her new work on sound.
Yeah.
I want to be her helper. I'll go and carry her bag for her.
Tell her.
Yeah, I will. Yeah, I also really liked her saying death has never scared me. You know, her lack of fear combined with the combination and that scientific fascination of it is interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, and I feel like that looped back to something she said at the very beginning about fear versus curiosity and how, and I think that is a really central part of morbid anatomy, and our mission as well is to replace fear with curiosity. I do think, when we're confronted with a mystery, we can be afraid and we can be curious, and sometimes both, But if you can find a way to have curiosity, it really can change your ability to engage with something and your feelings about it.
I agree.
Great. Wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us on Memento Morbid. Don't forget, if you have your own Memento Morbid, a story, memory, or reflection, perhaps even a question, please send us a WhatsApp voice note. You will find the number in the episode description. Just add it to your contacts. To find out more about Morbid Anatomy and our happenings, you can visit our website at morbidanatomy.org. You can also find us at Morbid Anatomy on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok, or check out our Substack at morbidanatomy.substack.com. Memento Morbid is produced by Overcoat Media in partnership with Morbid Anatomy. I'm your host, Joanna Ebenstein. The series producer is Jess Gunasekra. Studio engineer, Fernando Velasco. Additional production and sound design by Katie Hill. Executive producer, Stephen Rajam.